You're listening to Gilder 4 Radio, broadcasting live across the swamp, the hive, outlands, and the far reaches of the Ash Wave.
Hey everyone, welcome to Gildersford Radio, broadcasting live deep from the heart of Gildersford's notorious Eastgate Docks. I'm Lee, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Dixie, Roscoe, Lawrence and Gaz. Welcome back, sump dwellers, uphivers and everyone in between. It's been a pretty interesting month for GFR and the denizens of Gildersford. We've kicked off the Back to Basics campaign, yes, the super stripped down version of things that our arbitration overlord Dixie has concocted. We've just completed week 2, and it's been really interesting and a nice pleasant change. No fancy weapons, no tactics cards, just gangs duking it out. To go along with that, we of course have the new rules in hand and have been implementing them as best as possible. We'll be taking a deep dive into both the goings on from the campaign, our initial reactions to the new rules, and how everything has been affected by them, both bad and good. So pry out that bottle of Wildsnake and settle in for a great episode. It's time to introduce everyone. Say hello, Dixie.
Hello.
Say hello, Gaz.
Hiya.
Say hello, Roscoe.
Hello.
Say hello, Lawrence.
Hello.
Say hello, Lee. Hello, Lee. So we've just concluded week 2 of the Back to Basics campaign, and we're going to have a proper discussion about it and the new rules and everything associated with it. Personally, I think it's going fantastically. But other than that, how is everybody? Are we properly vacationed and rested?
Absolutely not.
Never enough.
No? Okay, fine. But before we dive into the campaign, Roscoe, you have a little community update for us all.
Yeah. As always, really, really grateful to everyone that reaches out to us, sends their messages, tags us in their posts and their hobby progress. But we got to give a couple of big shout-outs in particular. The original, although possibly not the best, podcast in the Underhive, Sump City Radio, back after a six-month hiatus. We'd just like to say thank you for the shout-out that they themselves gave us. We've also got a shout-out from across the pond from the Necromunt Show podcast, who have given Dixie's tactics card method its due acknowledgement. So thank you very much, boys. Appreciate that. And then finally, as you may have already seen on socials in the previous week, we've also got our first example of Lawrence's Ash Wastes map tool actually being used in the wild. So a big shout out to the Indianapolis Northside Necromunda community and their arbitrator, Jeff, who is actively using Lawrence's map tool to plot out that campaign. And they have a total of 10 players. And he said that it is invaluable as a resource if you're trying to manage that many people on a map, which is certainly something you found yourself, Dixie, didn't you?
Yes, very, very useful to keep on top of things, because trying to do that in a, you know, on pieces of paper or an Excel spreadsheet or something is nigh on impossible when you get to those numbers.
Yeah,
yes, I mean, we found, you know, it only takes one mistake and it can throw the campaign. So, I'm glad it's working out for you guys. And, do let us know if there's any suggestions as well.
It all goes into the backlog.
And of course, if you're not sure where to find that, if you head over to our socials, Facebook community page, Instagram, Gareth lurks on Discord like a Dalact Nactigal from time to time. But you can go and find our link tree. So that's Gildersford Radio link tree. And the community map tool is easy to find on there.
Fantastic. Right. So having that got that out of the way, the campaign, gentlemen, Back to Basics, week 2. How are we doing? I think we need to, should we do a little roundup of who's doing what first in terms of gangs, and then dive into how things have been going and how people have been finding? Because I'm really super interested about not only the campaign, but also because we have the new rules and the new rule book, how that's been. I think this is the first time that we've really used it in anger in terms of, you know, the changes, and what do we think, you know, are they working out as well as we thought they might, or has something come up that we weren't expecting? So who wants, and obviously Dixie as arbitrator, you know, you have an oversight kind of perspective as well. So what are we thinking?
Don't all rush at once.
No. Everyone's been too polite.
I was going to say, I was only present for the first week. So for my part, I've run with the Dalac, largely because I had a number of models from Gareth's First Blood campaign. So almost like the core of a small gang. So I've rolled out a number, I think it was 3 or 4 more models, got me the bare minimum I needed. And it's been interesting because with the restricted weapons list, it's a lot of the choices, a lot of the weapon choices, the ones you'd expect, especially for the gangers. You know, I've got my obligatory las gunner, I've got my auto gunner, I've got my shotgunner. But because of the limitations on leaders, or rather the leaders being the only fighters that have access to kind of the interesting gang-specific stuff, I rolled out a grav gun, and it is interesting. I was literally learning as I went because I'd never rolled one before. But particularly in a campaign where we've got very little or almost no armor on a lot of fighters, the grav gun was doing work. But the roll against their strength or under, of course, with your typical strength three, it's a 50-50. Either it's going to do some serious work with no armor save, or they'll just ignore it apart from the movement. So that's been kind of interesting. And I think with a scaled back in terms of equipment campaign, something that has an area of effect is it's been good. It, you know, it's slowing down the advance, at least on the back of the first Noni game I've played.
It's interesting you said about armor, because obviously with restricted weapons, I wonder whether more people will spend those points on war gear, and obviously armor is quite an obvious choice with
that. Yeah, and that's certainly how I led. I've armored up my leader and champs, but I mean that's par for the course. I do that with most campaigns. But yeah, I agree, Lawrence. I'd be surprised if we don't see more people investing more in armor for their gangers than they ordinarily would, perhaps.
So it's interesting. Our game last night, I was facing Tom, and his Vansar were all 4+ across the board, which with Vansar is quite easy because they've got the armored undersuits or the
yeah, I've done exactly the same.
So you know, it's just by mesh for every fighter, and you know, against the AP dash weapons, it does give him that staying power on the tabletop, even with a 6-fighter gang, until he comes across a mechanic that bypasses it. And then he just kind of, again, Tom being a more newer player, didn't seem to quite know how to deal with that. And you know, in this case, it was the template gas weapon. So you know, having two champions lined up next to each other was perhaps not the best idea. But you know, that's how we learn through being poisoned to death with gas, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I do the same. I mean, I've been playing Dalak, and I equally took a grav gun, and it's been the most effective weapon in both games. I mean, I've out of actioned a lot of people using it, and it is just that, like you say, Roscoe, it's that 50-50. But equally, like you say, the AOE that it does, because not having many blast weapons as well makes a massive difference. So I was skeptical and then got really hot dice in the first game and 3 out of actions from it. And last night when I was playing Colin, and yes, that Colin of Monster fame, hello Colin, he for some bizarre reason decided to bunch up his leader with 4 other guys, and I just consistently kept hitting them every turn. And didn't actually do much in terms of damage, but just, you know, the blast weapon making a big difference.
I feel it's worth giving a shout out to one of our other new players, Tim, whose Cordor I faced off against. It turns out that Tim is as bad at rolling ones in close combat as I am at rolling ones on a 2+ to shoot. Because while the grav gun did some work, I could not take anyone out of action, and I had literally at my feet this fighter of his, and I could not hit them for toffee, even with a 2+ to hit. He then used one of the articles of faith to get this fighter stood up, who then ran screaming and blew themselves up. But in a flip reversal, that fighter took themselves out of action, but did nothing beyond pinning my two. So it was just swinging back and forth, and it was like we're fighting with wet gloves on.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what happened in the game I had with Dixie when you sent one of your bone pickers against me, didn't you, Dixie? And that exact situation happened.
Yeah, exactly. She ran out. She'd taken 2 flesh wounds. So I thought, well, she's going to go out of action next turn. So we may as well see what this Article of Faith does from Path of the Doomed. Ran her out, blew her up. And she pinned your fighter and I think sent herself to the as a critical injury to the doctors, from memory.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Which makes a lot of sense, considering. But
yeah,
it was surprisingly ineffective.
I was at least expecting to roll an armor save, but I didn't even have to. Interestingly, I took the rad cannon, and to echo what Lee and Ross have been saying about the blast weapons, I found that to be the most effective tool in my arsenal, in my starting gang, which really isn't a surprise considering everybody else has got either a LAS pistol or a LAS gun. You know, apart from the Neotech, who's got a grenade as well. But surprisingly, just even just the pinning with it. And I haven't really had Radphage proc very often. I think maybe 3 or 4 times at most. But interestingly, with even with the strength too, it seems to consistently be wounding. I just put down the luck with the dice, but it's by far the best tool I've got at the moment.
So interestingly, for those of us that are using blast weapons, have you been trying to aim at people or going for the -1 on the I'm not aiming, but I'm trying to maximize my coverage with a template?
Well, I took the ocular upgrade on my leader,
right?
Which is basically an infrasight, and so you can take that. It's the only way to get an infrasight on a blast weapon. Nice. And so I took it in order to be able to hit fighters behind cover, because it basically makes heavy cover count as partial and partial cover negated, and therefore it shouldn't scatter too much. I found that it was advantageous a lot on the Zone Mortalis games that I played to occasionally aim for a point on the battlefield. Whereas last night when I played against Callum's Escher, and we were playing on Sector Mechanicus, we had this sort of like half mound of rubble and ruins in the middle of the board. And so I couldn't, there was a point where if I'd have been able to see the point on the board, I'd have been able to catch 3 of his fighters under the template. But because of that terrain being in the way, I couldn't see over it to see that point on the battlefield I needed to target. Whereas with Zone Mortalis, everything's very flat. That kind of lent an interesting dynamic to it that I wasn't expecting, to be honest.
Although interesting last night, and again, one of my gripes is Sector Mechanicus, and immediately I'm thinking levels, and then we walked in and it was not flat, but it was one level terrain, and I was okay. So it's always that expectation of like in my head, and I think this is old Munda coming in, where I think of those immediately think of the card stuff, 3 or 4 levels, all the rest of it, and it's kind of not a Sector Mechanicus fight unless I've got a strength 9 hit coming from falling off of a gantry.
Yeah, unfortunately, the problem there, though, Lee, is we have to be able to store and transport 7 or 8 tables worth of club terrain.
No, I know. It's just like in my head, you say Sector Mechanicus, and I immediately think of high levels and gantries, and it's.
If you're really missing it, I can give you a push.
I was about to say, Lawrence, at the risk of throwing you under the bus live on air, you've got that. You printed that amazing Kowloon inspired sort of. City, didn't you? And
yeah,
you know, no pressure, get that painted, pal. Come on, let's get that on the board.
It's getting there. There's a lot of it,
you've been a busy boy with other things as well, to be fair to you.
I've got a lot of Tesseract Tomb stuff that I've been working on, and I need a lot of scatter terrain. That's the thing I need to do to get my stuff finished.
I think as we've got quite a few different, you know, quite a lot of variety now in tables and terrain, scatter, etc., and I think as members of the club, you know, continue to grow. Like, there's going to be people going, oh, well, I'm actually going to bring. I think Tom brought down some of his this week, and he actually brought some gantries along and some sort and of mid, actually, mid-height and
actually, infamously, that actually got used properly as well. You know, we were up on the gantries.
Oh, good.
The only criticism I would probably say about perhaps why Tom had put it together was there's only one way in, one way on, and one way off. Well,
no,
one way on. Yeah. There's always another way off. Yeah. but yeah, there was only one way on at each end of the gantry, which just one of my pet peeves. There should be ladders everywhere.
Well, you can climb.
You can, as long as it's not suspended in the air with nothing to climb on.
Yes, exactly.
True, yeah.
But
I mean, lots of ramps in a Sector Mechanicus game, and lots of ladders as well, because, you know, the old bolt, every bulkhead in old Munda was effectively a ladder.
Yeah, indeed. No, I mean, certainly to give Tom his dues, the whole lot was, you know, at least tabletop ready painted. I mean, I said to him afterwards, you know, it'd be lovely to see some colour on there. But no, it certainly looked like it had all been kind of dripped on with acid for the past 10,000 years, which is, you know, exactly what it should be. And actually, you know, it was a really good tabletop to play on, actually. So, you know, it's great to see some of those other kind of members bring bring some of their own terrain down. And, you know, I gently chided him for how carefully he was packing it away. But in all fairness, you know, he if you're going to bring kind of £200-300 worth of Games Workshop terrain, fair enough, yeah. And, you know, and again, we at the club don't treat we just don't treat the terrain that well.
Well, I mean, we're better than we used to be. I mean, some of the older club terrain has taken a proper battering, some of the MDF stuff. I think we're better than we used to be, but yeah, it's a fair point. Mm.
Well, someone keeps letting the 40K players chew on it, which is really not...
they just can't help themselves.
We'll have to bring in more packs of crayons.
Yeah.
Shots fired.
I thought bucketfuls of dice normally did the job, didn't it?
That's the Tyranid players.
Well, no, it's fair. I mean, let's say as a Tyranid player myself, no, it's really not. So
it's, you know. No, I play orcs. So, you know, I regularly used to literally have a you know, the cup that you get the massive size Starbuck in.
Yeah,
I used to roll my dice from that.
Yeah, I think a number of times. Contemplated the notion of printing a dice tower because I was like, you know, just to kind of keep everything in one place. I never got round to it.
I'll have to share mine.
It's funny, Lee. I was driving today thinking because I'm sorry that I can't give a shout out to the designer, but there's a ubiquitous 3D print Necromunda tower and it's lovely. And I'm always tempted to hunt down the file wherever.
I think I've seen that on Thingiverse. Yeah.
I know Tesseract Tomb do one, and I think
there's a Thingiverse one that we can share with you, and maybe we should put in the chat actually in the socials.
While we're chatting, see if I can find it.
Because there we go. There's an action.
The one I'm thinking of because it is effectively a terrain piece, albeit impassable. You don't want your model decapitated by a die, obviously. But the fact it sort of sits on the table and is enmeshed in it, I really like that it's, you know, it's not incongruous. And the design's just really, really stylish. And I don't know, am I on commission? I start to sound like I'm on commission here.
Here we go. It's called Necromunda Dice Tower. It's by Sir Bats. And again, we can probably put that in the socials. But yeah,
Sir Bats, we salute you.
It's kind of got like a sewage works look to it.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, the author has actually got a load of the house logos as well that you can kind of print out and stick on the front.
Yeah.
So there's
that's very cool.
Yeah, no, really nice.
Right, it's downloading as we speak and it will go on the 3D printer later.
I would also recommend, if you can do it, to fill the bottom of the tray with UV resin and so you actually have a nice pool effect.
I did for my Zomortalis stuff.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen some really gloopy renditions of it. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's well worth doing. And again, you know, it's also, it doesn't look out of place on the tabletop. So plonk it right in the middle and you can both use it, you know.
Cool.
But I think what I've taken away from this is that my next project needs to be actually getting my hab stacks and stuff from the two Ash Waste sets built so that we can use those for Terrain Knights and I can just put them in a big useful container, and bring them down, foam it out or whatever.
Yeah.
And then when we want to do sec mech, we should have plenty of walkways then and bits
well,
and pieces.
Well, in that regard, Gaz, I happened to be in home base the other day and for our listeners outside of the UK, home base is like Lowe's,
Home Depot,
or your local big box DIY store, whatever you know, your mileage may vary. They've got a remarkable sale on those kinds of big, useful storage containers, like some really good deals. So I'd get in quick.
I need to go down there then.
I think a few of you have seen how far down the rabbit hole I've gone with really useful, because I've now got really useful boxes for my Zomortalis tiles, my Zomortalis terrain in a different shape box, and I've got enough of the right size, really useful boxes for all of the tactics cards boxes. I don't want to add up the grand total of amount of plastic boxes I've bought, if I'm honest.
You guys who don't do historical wargaming, you poor innocent people.
Rookie numbers, huh?
All you need now, Ross, is the label maker so that you can label them properly.
Oh my.
Take the blue pill.
I kind of feel we've strayed into our hobby section.
No, we'll get to that later.
Well, bring it back in then. So as always, I'm not necessarily playing properly in this campaign, but I have created a gang and it's a Cawdor gang. And I have immediately done a Lee and shot myself in the foot narratively.
Hey.
With the Devoted of Malachi the Small. So I was hunting around trying to find a suitable idea for a leader for my Cawdor gang, and I came across a this will take a few of our listeners back, I'm sure. A 1980 something monk from Terror of the Leashmaster.
Oh wow!
Yes, it would go real far back down the rabbit hole. But he's sort of turned into this kind of perfect. It's a guy with this. He's got a book under one arm and scrolls under the other, and a robe on. So he became my leader. He's Malachi the Small. He's a child prophet of the emperor.
He's about to be eaten by your chimerics.
Nah, he's fine. But he has no weapons, no armor. He has a cherub and a mediskull and a book of the redemption. And he leads the gang, and the rest of the gang is themed around him. And they're all just, you know, chaff with no armor and very small weapons and spreading the word of Malachi.
Oh, you did actually go for weapons. I thought you were going no weapons, completely no weapons.
None of the bone pickers have weapons. So.
That's a brilliant move. That's a genius move.
And they still managed to make my gang bottle on turn one of our game.
Yeah, so we did a catch up game basically just so I could get some dice rolling. The opening shot of the game with an auto gun seriously injured one of your fighters, caused another fighter to break, which was enough to trigger a bottle check, which you immediately failed and broke. Yep. at the end of turn one. And then just passed every single possible leadership test, or call check, sorry, to stick around for the following five turns or something. I think we played until 1 o'clock in the morning or something stupid, didn't we? It was ridiculous.
That's right, yeah.
It was a very good, fun game, and there were so many like stupid moments, like the guy with the bomb rats putting a blasting charge down, failing the willpower check, and the rat moving into a wall next to him, blowing up and taking out three of my own fighters instantly.
Them ran, and the other one saw him sit up and light a cigarette and decided that they were too stupid to run.
Yeah, so the guy who had the bomb rat also has low sticks, and the two bone pickers that were injured, one of them was just bleeding out on the floor. The other one was also sort of flesh wounded, but passed the call check because she was just watching him smoking a cigarette upside down on the floor.
That's who I want to be.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So, but yeah, it was a fun game. There were lots of silly moments, but... The restricted weapons list does make a huge difference, I think, and it's quite interesting having watched. You know, I actually missed the second game because I've been at a reenactment event all weekend, and it's been chaos, real life outside of Necromunda, unfortunately. At the moment, it's been a little bit hectic. But the first week, the games, you know, it was interesting to note how much people could concentrate on just playing the game without having to worry about all the ancillary stuff like the tactics cards and missions and
or even remembering like umpteen traits and
so that's been really good. And I think the territories and the simple, you know, the standardized universal scenario rewards and stuff like that, I think have made things a lot easier for people to anticipate what's going to happen at the end of a game. And not immediately find themselves having, you know, lost six fighters during the game and only earning 8 credits from the income, as we had in certain Ashgate game campaign games and things like that.
Yep.
Definitely true, yeah. So for me, it's been an opportunity, like a couple of you have also said, you know, to try some of the stuff that I tend to leave at home because it doesn't look like I will have fun with it. So it's been an opportunity to, for example, I've never actually played the Fear Cats that I bought. So I definitely took the opportunity to paint one of those up, and I also try out a new painting technique like a tutorial that I'd seen. But interestingly, it was a tutorial for canvas painting of fur, and I thought, okay, we'll see if I can transfer this to, you know, a miniature. And you know, I'm still not 100% sure about it, but actually, I got some kind of reassuring feedback that actually it looked okay. So, it's been kind of a
little cat thing.
The fear cat.
Yeah, that looked awesome.
Yeah, I'm still not 100% sure on it, if I'm honest, but I'll take other people's opinion and I'll put it down. Because, of course, being textured, I wanted it to look different from my usual painting style.
Considering how tiny a brush you were working with, Lawrence, I think you're doing a really good job. The fur texture works for me, at the very least.
I use the War Game Painter, I think that's their name, brushes, and I either use the Insane Detail or the Psycho, and the Psycho you need a microscope to see the bristles. There's about two.
It's a fair point actually about how removing the kind of fixation on weapons is it's opening up avenues, because I have bought and was literally just painting before recording the giant rat that I've bought for my Dalak Nakt Gul. At least I run it as a giant rat, but what I treated myself to was one of the old Warhammer Fantasy snake swarms, the old metal ones. So the biggest of the bunch off the square base they came with. Once they'd had a Detol bath, he's painted up, and he'll be Susurrus the serpent will be rolled out as a giant rat proxy.
A simple green for those in America.
Yeah.
Other
strippers are available, so to speak.
Close enough.
Steady.
But it's one of those older sculpts, and it's I want to say charmingly goofy. I think it might even be a Trish Carden original, and obviously she's an absolute titan of monster sculpting for GW all the way down the years.
She did the dragons originally, didn't she?
Oh, she did all the good stuff. She's definitely worth following on the socials if people don't already. Trish Carden. So it's this oversized serpent, and I'm sure it'll make it onto the socials along with a load of photos of our other fighters, other gangs as well.
I think my favorite my favorite one I've done so far was the propagandist conversion from the Blood Bowl elf referee, which is an idea that's been kicking around in my head for quite some time.
Once you'd done it, it was such an obvious thing to do with it holding up the. I mean, obviously, it's supposed to be a red card.
Yeah,
but it's such. Yeah, it's such a natural stance for some zealot making proclamations from a grubby sort of pamphlet, right?
Yeah, I mean, I bought the model about, I don't know, 6 months ago, because I saw somebody had done it popped up on Facebook or Instagram or something as the Blood Bowl version. I thought, oh, I saw the conversion in my head, and I thought I'll order the model. I found it on eBay or whatever it was, got it in, and then when we were sort of setting up this campaign, I was thinking maybe I'll do Cawdor because I haven't played them for a long time, and I actually started with that model. But the fun bit was carving out the face to put a Cawdor Ganger's face on there with the hood. The rest of it's pretty straightforward.
I mean, it's come off beautifully.
I've been working on my Dalak, and I decided to go as Psyker as possible, you know, as many Psykers. So fundamentally, I've got a whole load of Psygeist prospects that have all got various, very short range, not particularly offensive psychic powers with throwing knives, and then a leader with a grav gun. And I've gone for lots of spatial psychosis, so lots of like create cover. I like the idea of using suicidal embrace, so I can walk up to people and have them punch themselves in the face, which kind of sometimes works. I've only actually played. Well, we played Ross's Beast. What was it, Ross? Your sump horror game,
Into the Depths.
Into the Depths. Thank you. I tested some psychic powers with that one first, and me and Angus had a kind of our own little private fight where I was getting in to punch himself, and then he was shooting me, kind of idea, and it kind of works out. But I have to say, in the auspices of the campaign itself, the range is hurting, because I think the longest range psychic power I've got is 12 inches, which is the pinning. You know, you can basically make somebody pin, and if they happen to be on a ledge, you can make them fall off. It will make them take an initiative test. And then 10 inch for the cover. And then everything else is either 3 inches or 5 inches. So I haven't had a massive amount of opportunity to try things like suicidal embrace, but generally speaking, I'm enjoying the sneaky. And obviously my Nakt Gul, and I think you do the same thing, Ross, has got the built-in or the cooked-in infiltrate. So that has been monstrously effective in it showing up and being armed with both the fighting knife and the backstab skill and popping out from nowhere and going splat. Yeah. And I have, last night, I did actually manage to proc the psychic power that one of my psychic powers is I can turn someone's facing. So I spun the facing and then charged him around the corner and backstab with full backstab effect. It was quite good.
In terms of the psychic, are you thinking of throwing some credits towards what are your two options, the psychoteric worms or the psychoteric thralls, right? And they're the ones that will give you that that boost to your range potentially. Yeah, because they connect to Seal.
I've got some money. I mean, I lost last night's game, so I've got about 50 creds in the stash there or thereabouts after buying another ganger last week. I think I felt like I needed just a regular ganger with a gun. Actually, I bought a regular ganger, a ghost, with a long lass, and it was surprisingly effective. Stick it at the back of the field, aim, don't move, hitting on twos fundamentally all the time because I'm at long range and I'm aiming. And yeah, that was really effective actually for a, you know, I don't want to do too much shooting army. But yeah, I was looking at the next kind of upgrade is going to be, other than skills and maybe boosting toughness and strength on some guys, or maybe looking at armor. Yeah, the worms are definitely something I need to spend some time researching and investing in.
So I was just going to ask, it's been a while since I've read House of Shadows, but I was under the impression that as long as your other guys within sort of like a coherency of three or whatever, that they can add to the range of your psychic powers.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But it is capped at three fighters and 3 inches, so that they each add one. But there is that cap to the effect. Psychoteric whispers, I think, might be the.
Right, that's it. Yeah. So effect. I was just wondering, is Lee, have you been utilizing that?
No, to be honest with you, because I think I was very aware that because it's all fundamentally prospects, I haven't really been stringing them out. I've been kind of keeping them fairly close to each other in an effect to try to kind of help each other. So I haven't really had too much opportunity to do that. And again, when I get close enough, it's actually more in terms of really close stuff for things like the suicidal embrace. The champion and the gang leader, who's armed with a shock stave as well, have actually been more effective in combat rather than I'm going to try a psychic power. I'm just going to go slap either with the fighting knife and use, you know, various attacks or the shock stave, which again last night was great. Actually managed, I think for the first time ever, managed to roll a 6 for the shock and created a shock attack. So. Yeah, I mean,
nice.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever, I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure I've never actually managed to proc that before. So it was quite good.
Shocking.
But I need to lean more into the side, like really understand how the psychic's going. I mean, I threw throwing knives on all of the prospects for 10 creds. And of course, with their rubbish weapons, ballistic skill, I haven't hit once. And because they're scarce, I think most of them have actually run out of knives in the game, so it's kind of like, all right,
I have been considering picking those up for my Jews actually, because my Jews have got like a 4+ ballistic skill, and I was thinking of taking them as like an additional weapon just for the toxin.
I think for 10 creds, I mean, if you can pull it off, the toxin, I mean, I looked at it and went, oh, 10 creds toxin, I mean, that's amazing, but obviously the weapon skill, the ballistic skill, sorry, is the thing that will really kill it. So if you've got better ballistic skill, or, you know, maybe stand, yeah, again, it's only strength times 2, so you're at 6-inch range. So
is there a negative at long range on those as well? Is that right?
I don't think so.
I think they just have a flat range, don't they? I can't remember.
Strength, got it here. Throwing knives. Hang on a minute. Is that right? Oh, yeah. No, actually, strength. Is that this? I'm looking at Necrodamus. I'm not sure if this is updated. But according to this, which I must have missed, strength times 4 at long range with -1 to hit, which I just thought it was strength times 2. Maybe that's a short range.
Yes, I think you're probably right. Times X weapons have a short or long range because it's strength times X.
This must, again, I'm just looking, it might be incorrect. Anyway, but I didn't think there was any negatives. It was strength times 2, and that's just what it is. But
so looking it up here on the new book, I can look it up straight away for you. What were they called again? Throwing knives. Looking for a T. There we go. Throwing knives, strength times 2 short, strength times 4 long, -1 long, and -1 AP. Scare silent toxin.
Toxin in 10 creds. So it's strength times 4, but -1. So that would make it 6s to hit with my prospects, which is...
But interesting, within this campaign variant, If you give them to a fighter with a better ballistic skill, it's one of the few toxin kind of options that are widely available.
True.
In fact, only.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. True.
So I've not leaned into it with my Dalak, but I'm definitely, as a backup weapon, it's almost as good an option as an auto pistol, perhaps.
I think you've just given me a workaround.
Unarmed bone pickers are still the way forward, I'm afraid.
See, I've been drawn to it from a fluff perspective because the flavour of my gang is that they kind of revere the raft spiders. So Lee pointed out last night that my paint scheme actually highly reflects the Sardaukar from June, which is entirely unintentional, but I'm actually really pleased that I've there's just some sort of like worm in my head that's actually made me do that after doing the Fremen inspired.
I know you've got a June thing going on, and I hadn't seen your gang, and I sat down, having played and lost to Colin last night, sat down in front of your table and went, oh, they Sardaukar, and he went, oh, no, but yes.
They literally are. All I've got to do is paint the like the kneecaps and the, you know, the little lines on the kneecaps and the shoulders red, and they will look almost exactly like Sardaukar, which I'm really pleased with, actually. So that's inspired me to do one with like a long sword blade, which I'll probably steal off a Nachtgaul or something at some point. But yeah, no, I love that. I was drawn to it from a fluff perspective because I like the idea that they like extract venom from the spiders and stuff that are down in the sump. So you might see some throwing knives turn up on them towards the latter part of the campaign as like a backup weapon.
I have to say the biggest question of this episode, Lee, largely because I was absent myself, we haven't really talked enough about the return of the infamous, famous, legendary Colin.
Well, no, I mean, we haven't, but it was lovely to see him. I mean, I'm trying to work out how long it's been. It must be 3 years. It was before COVID.
I think
COVID.
He said 4 years.
4 years. Yeah. I mean, I knew he left before COVID. So, I mean, he was down and his missus was with him. And again, me and names, I apologise. I've completely forgotten. Is it Abby? Might be. Okay, I can't remember. I'm really bad with names. But no, we had a great game. He was playing Orlocks, and it wasn't a particularly OP thing at all. He had awful lots of pistols. And it was one of those games. It was very, very similar to the game that I played the first week against Tom, where it went right down to the wire. We were really close on points, and I bottled, because he started with 10. I started with 8. Actually, strictly speaking, he should have started with 7, because I read the dock rules incorrectly, or hangers-on rules incorrectly, but it made not a lot of difference. And I bottled, and that was actually the thing that swung it, because of the points, you know, losing the leader, 3 points, gone. But no, it was a phenomenal game, and just, it was really nice to kind of just get back to, you know, get to see him again, and yeah, just, you know, chatting about old times. And then he brought Monster out, and I didn't get involved in that, having had the ganking from Monster the first time round. So I let Lawrence and others and Ethan and whatnot get involved. And Lawrence, you countered it quite effectively with a Hyper Maiden, I understand.
Yeah, so we had to do a little bit of metagaming because obviously we weren't playing a full game. So we kind of said, well, you know, Monster had a big charge. I think we worked out that Hyper Maiden had a bigger one, and so therefore the Hyper Maiden probably had the charge. If she does, she wins every time. Aside from, you know, a few unlucky rolls. But we kept it relatively simple and stripped the builds back to their basics. So the Hyper Maiden had Friends on, a toxin weapon, and the a chem synth, and the concentrated toxin. Yeah. And with that first attack, you know, she's throwing out about 8 dice, something like that. And typically, you know, hitting on all but one of them. And then with each hit, with the various skills that the monster has, you know, she's rolling 3 injury dice while monster gets to pick which one he chooses. But yes, you know, with that volume of dice, inevitably a serious injury or out of action comes out of it anyway. And then either the Hyper Maiden coup de grace or he's already dead. That said, I think actually if the dice go unlucky for you and monster either pulls off a save or enough saves, or you just utterly whiff on the dice, it's game over. You know, monster wins.
Do you think, I mean, having played monster, do you think there's a significant difference between it and your Gene Smith renderizer nutcase brute with 14 attacks on the charge?
He's tougher because he's definitely gone with a lot more of the resiliency stuff. So I can't remember the names of the skills now, but the true grit and nerves of steel and so on and so on and so on. And then probably 2 toughness upgrades.
Yeah.
Obviously, I often go with a toughness 5 stimmer, but the number of attacks the stimmer throws out, just without having to, but just building the model on the sprue, is ludicrous. Again, there's a little bit of debate as to exactly how that works in the ruling, whether or not it's the combat stims increase its attack characteristics and therefore is doubled as part of. That's my interpretation, because it says it ups the characteristic.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. If it says it ups the characteristic, then paired works off of that number.
Yeah. So again, you know, and again, also, do you include an extra dice for paired weapons? I think that might have got cleaned up in the latest book, actually. I need to double check.
So is that saying you take the characteristics, and because you've got paired weapons, you double it, and then you add your D3 and all the rest of it because of the renderizer, or is it you?
So it should be, as I understand it, he's got, if I can recall correctly, three attacks base.
Yeah.
He has a D3 from the combat drugs that increases his characteristic. Now, I might be wrong about this, so I'm doing it from memory. So potentially 6 base. The paired renderizers double and counters 2 weapons. So that's 12 plus 1 is 13 and 14 on the charge.
Which combat drugs?
No. It's the Stimmer's special rule. So he comes with a built-in unique set of combat drugs that just do it for that model. And I'm just grabbing my House of Chains book now to get you the exact name of the rule.
Combat Chem's Stash can roll D6 when activated to modify the attack characteristic.
And can go wrong. Can go wrong. You can roll a 1 and it's all over. But
yeah. But it's a D6, not a D3. But I suppose it effectively is a D3 because it's 5 to 6 is plus 3 attacks. Yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is the attack characteristic. So if you are good and rolled 3, you effectively get 6 attacks characteristic, which then gets doubled by the renderizer.
Paired renderizers, clues in the name. I have to admit, the only downside of that is that weapon isn't that impressive. I think it's got 1 AP on it and it's strength plus 1, if I recall correctly. It's not game breaking.
It doesn't need to be that effective when there's 14.
When you're throwing 14 attacks, yeah.
I mean, just out of interest, just looking in the new book, paired doesn't show up as a trait in the list of traits.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
No, because there are no trading post weapons that have the trait paired, because they're all house based weapons for Dalak, for example, and for
strength plus 2.
Well, Vansar get it on the Spider Rig as well. Is the one other exception?
Okay.
Yeah, I think they've put the traits for the weapons they've published in the book rather than a complete list of traits, because I guess the risk there is they say, here is a complete list of traits, and then a week later they publish a new book that's got a new trait in it. It's saying it's a complete list of traits is a bit dangerous.
Yeah.
I'm just digging out the rules for the paired renderizers.
I guess the one thing we should do at the close of this episode is actually get in contact with Colin and ask him to send the build over, and then we can share it with the community, and perhaps Monster can visit a Hive subsector of your own, perhaps.
We did actually talk about that ages ago when we were working out doing some stacks of wax, so I may have that, but it'd be worth double-checking to see if he's modified anything based on the new rules.
And what is interesting is what he was saying was, you know, this is all stems back to kind of N17 when the new rule set first released.
Yeah.
And of course, back then there was no, in fact, you know, given the choice, he would have had probably have had the Stimmer and it would have been, you know, even filthier. You know, back then there was no Death Maiden.
That's true.
So it all things in context, right? You know, it was filthy then. The power levels have moved since, and it's actually not as terrible as you might think. And you know, we in the community have come up with all sorts of horrible things. If I'm honest, I'm starting to feel sorry for Monster. Monster is looking tame.
But he was a trailblazer, right? In a, you know, and back in the day when chem stims could be used every single turn, you know, he took full advantage of it, and that got nerfed because it was, well, broken. But you know, I mean, and the meta always, as we well know, meta always shifts, and everyone will try and find out, you know, what's going on, be it Necromunda, be it 40k, be it whatever you're playing, right?
Yeah, I say so, I I was, aside from Monster, I was experimenting with a new chem that I hadn't tried out yet, mostly because I've never really used the gas weapons. I've always used the toxins. And I mostly don't like gas weapons because they don't pin. And I as a tactic, make quite a lot of use of that. And, you know, it always kind of irks me, you know, even if I succeed in that toughness check to inflict damage, I could roll a flesh wound and then I get shot back. So I tried the blinding toxin on my chem thrower, and I absolutely love that. And for 10 credits, it's an absolute steal as well. Essentially what it does is if you roll a flesh wound on that injury dice, it automatically confers the blinding condition to the fighter you've wounded. Right. So it means that there's no bad dice roll, basically. If you flesh wound them, they take the flesh wound and they lose their activation.
They're seriously injured and it's
gone. Or they're seriously injured.
Yeah.
Or they're out of action. There's literally no bad outcome. 10 credits, and then obviously you're going to pair that with the chem synth, so you're wounding them on twos. And for 10 credits, I thought, and plus you then combine that with other stuff, like things like the, I think it's acidic or something like that, that chews through the respirators and things like that.
Yeah.
As I said, I hadn't really played with the gas weapons very much. And I'm actually quite surprised that I'm liking what I'm seeing, actually, because normally I just dislike the fact they don't pin and therefore avoid them.
Yeah, I've never played with gas weapons, so I think that's because of the gangs that I've played. So, interesting.
Well, I say, I think anyone can go to the trading post and get the choke grenades.
Well, it always seems like they're for like the choke grenades, like 40 or 50 creds. Because actually, I was looking and just going, I just don't think I can justify the cost at the moment. And you always kind of go for, you know, especially when I'm playing Redemption, I always go for the blasting charges or demo charges or all that kind of stuff. And yeah, maybe need to look more into the gas weapons, the chem weapons, because of the more sort of insidious things that they can do.
And it was quite interesting because, of course, I was playing Tom's Vansar all with 4+ armor saves. And
you were just going straight through him?
Well, no. I mean, everything I shot at him pinged off his armor just about until I managed to get my leader into position. And again, you know, this comes with a little bit of experience. You know, you want to kind of spread your assets across the table so that they can't both be hit by a template weapon. But, you know, that kind of... Cool. I don't need to roll to hit. You don't get armor saves. I don't even have to worry about your wound characteristic. All I have to do is roll against your toughness, and no matter what I roll on this dice, I win. You know, it's suddenly that 140, well, 50 credit weapon now starting to look value for money. Mm. When previously I've always gone, doesn't pin. There's a 1 in 3 chance that it does a flesh wound, and then that model who is within 8 inches now dies. And I'd often used to put it on just a specialist, simply because I was thinking, well, they get to fire it once and then they probably go out of action and then they miss a game.
Yeah.
Obviously, this campaign's forced me to put it on a leader who's a little bit more tough. And actually, I'd be tempted to actually run a matriarch with one in lieu of a heavy stubber.
I mean, I suppose you're giving up a lot of range because it's obviously a template weapon, but I guess... You know, if you're guaranteeing an effect regardless of what you're doing, you're either pinning and blinding, or you're hurting and sort of
I mean, that's in many ways kind of the point of this campaign for me, is to A, try out the new rules, but B, also try out ideas that I've not played with before. And you know, in my go-to skirmish list, I'll always put a matriarch with a heavy stubber in it because that works. That's good. I know that works. But it's kind of given me an idea for, like, I don't have to do that. I can actually do it the extreme other end and go super close quarter fighting in a very effective way. It just opens up more options for the future, where I might have previously discarded a weapon saying, no, that doesn't work. Say, actually, it can be made to work, especially when you start adding in the stuff that the new books put on offer as well.
I'd echo that. I've taken options that you wouldn't see in a lot of Vansar lists. So where normally you'd see like a lot of fast shot or hip shooting and that, I've taken things like Medicaid. and I took Mentor on the leader, which I think is interesting because you've said there about the tactic of spreading your fighters out so they can't be hit by many blast templates. Mm. And that's a totally valid strategy. But what I found interesting with the new rules in relation to assistance with recovery,
yep,
and sort of that incentivization with XP as well for helping fighters recover, is I think that's probably changed the effectiveness of those template weapons and increased their effectiveness in a way, because you've got more instances where people are tempted or actually required to move to assist the fighter, because otherwise they're going to be taking a bottle check or losing a fighter. As in the last two scenarios we've played, the victory points are based on the fighters that are going out of action. So if your champ is down, you want to get someone there to get them up again, because otherwise they're costing they're costing you two VP. So it's definitely, the new rules have incentivized getting fighters close to each other, and therefore opening up more opportunity for blast and template.
One rule we spotted actually was that the assistance you can only do once. So a model can only assist one other model.
That's right.
And I wasn't aware of that. I'm not sure it might have been a thing before. Maybe we just played it wrong. But we had a scenario where both champions were serious injured, and Tom had the guy on a hoverboard, I forget his name, Neotech, to assist. And he definitely saved the life of one champion and might have saved the life of the other. And he said, but you know, this serious injury role counts as a flesh wound instead in this case. And said, it would have, but unfortunately you can only assist one when we actually check the rules. So again, the rules definitely make coordinated actions useful. What I often find is a good idea to do is always kind of pair a high value model with perhaps a medium ganger and a juve. The juve for fodder, because you know you're forcing those cool checks, especially if they're standing directly in the way. And also, you know, the juve, if nothing else, can quickly rally, on you know that your mentor skill works within 6 inches, and quite frankly, you know, juves are great for kind of quickly gaining little skills like Medicaid.
I was just about to say, I'm sure I'm not the only one who's considering in this campaign a Medicaid juve or prospect. If you've got, you know, if you've rolled in the trading post sufficiently high and rare that you can give them the Medicaid pack and then have them on the back line supporting your kind of front line of fighters. Especially if you've got a juve where they've got a good movement of 6, you know, if 12 inches gives them some versatility to get around the board and get in that position to assist in recovery.
I guess the only problem with that is
Malachi the Small has a Medi skull, because it's an interesting piece
interesting.
Of equipment.
Mm. So, I guess so the only problem with a Medicaid juve is I think that the number of houses that can actually pull that off is very limited. You're probably looking at getting a juve all the way up to 12 XP to be able to do it. In fact, it may even be 15 XP.
Well, no, because you can buy them the Medicaid pack, can't you? Not that they have to have the skill. They can assist in recovery. Yeah. And the Medicaid gives you the boost that Medicaid, the skill, would anyway, if memory serves. Although
it's slightly different. So the Medicaid skill has changed to an action now. It's a basic action. And on a 3+, you can remove a fighter's flesh wound. Or if they're a multiple wound model, you can give them a wound back, which has actually come into play for me in two of the games that I've played. I'm sure it would have cropped up last night had Callum not have instantly out of actioned my Archaeotech with a chem thrower. You know, just because I forgot she was behind a piece of cover and she popped out with priority and went move shoot. I found it incredibly useful. And I think what Ross is saying is the new Medicaid kit, is roll 2 dice. Anyway, and then obviously if you're assisting, that's a third dice. So
add a Mediscal, that's a fourth dice.
There you go. So you can quite quickly increase your chances of rolling a flesh wound and getting up and not incurring the flesh wound because you're being assisted. So
And in terms of if you wanted to play the long game of splinter gangs in the future, this is slightly meta, but there are far worse ways of accruing experience for a juve than to be the medic in the gang, because obviously based on their base stats, they're never very good at fighting or shooting, are they?
Well, I'm actually looking at chucking a Medicaid kit on my Neotech purely because of the 7-inch move. So, you know, that can be a 14 if I need it to be to get to somebody just to help them with a recovery.
Mm. I mean, 30 creds at rare 9 is pretty easy to come by. I was looking at the Medi Skull. I mean, a rare 12, 80 creds. I was sort of trying to do the kind of the mental maths on, is it better to do the Skull, assuming you've got the rare trade roll?
Isn't the Skull a status item, though, so only the leader can have it? Or champion?
It's on the corduroy equipment list anyway, so...
But what I was trying to get at is, regardless of who has it, is it better to have a Juve at 20, 30 creds, depending on the Juve cost and the Medicaid pack? So you're in for 50 or 60 creds, and it's its own, albeit not particularly fantastic, Juve versus the Medi Skull that's attached to your leader that's effectively an autonomous little thing that can work.
That was very much my rationale. It's pretty cost effective. And it's another cheap body on the table when it comes to bottle tests, you know, boys before toys and all that.
I'm not sure. I could see the argument both ways, actually, because again, I mean, yes, you do have your. I mean, what's the so the thing I don't know is what's the stat lines on the Medi Skull? Can they be targeted independently, or is it you target the leader? And if you
I think they can be caught by blast weapons, but they can't be specifically targeted. They're not pets or anything like that. So
it's you're paying a few creds more, albeit not with the blast weapons, to kind of almost have an immunity to this thing going off and doing what it needs to do close to your leader. So yes, it does mean your leader has to kind of move towards the injured people, but it can't be sniped. Because I mean, in the first game that I played, where my doc did actually have to show up, Tom was, and I ended up at three turns where his again the Neotech, the surfboard, you know, the hover dude was chasing the doc, because he's like, well, kill the doc, you can't then do the Medicaid, you know, runs and all the rest of it. So it's having that vulnerability of, like, you put a lot of effort into creating this thing that goes and helps people, only then to be shot by a sniper weapon or like taken down in close combat. I can see the benefits of the Medi Skull.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you. I say I think it's just a little bit expensive, and
80 creds.
Yeah, and as you say, I think Ross is on the money there. You know, a cheap Juve with a mini pack, and of course you can copy and paste that if you needed it.
True,
but it's not as fun a model as a Medi Skull.
Also, yeah, true.
So true,
definitely.
I mean, the reason I bought it more than anything else is because, you know, it's Malachi the Small. His friend is, he has a cherub, which is, and he has a Medi Skull. Those are his toys.
Yeah. No, but I mean, I think purely from a gaming perspective, I think it's kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other. You know, it kind of splits both ways. And I suspect statistically it's going to work out pretty even each way. Anyway, so it's kind of, you pick your flavor and you go with it.
Well, you could, the difference being, you can make a Juve break and run. Yes. So if you keep a Juve near your leader or your champ that would normally have that Medi Skull pet, for want of a better word, the Juve is likely to break and run, and then they're useless in terms of the recovery, whereas the Medi Skull is not going anywhere ever. So it's giving you that extra guarantee that you're actually going to get to roll the dice in the first place. So that's the baked-in benefit for the extra dice.
Yeah. I mean, talking about other models that kind of haven't seen the light of day yet. Ethan tried out and bought a Shiver for his Escher gang.
Oh, that's right.
He was telling me about this. Yeah,
and he rolled on the table, and he rolled in front of us, so he absolutely did pull this off. He had a mysterious stranger rock up, and essentially he's got a free bounty hunter for the next mission, which, I mean, the hanger-on is 100 credits, so it's an expensive hanger-on. But I'm seriously tempted at saving up, and I was looking through my miniature collection, seeing have I got something suitable. And there's a miniature I acquired a very, very long time ago that I think is perfect for this. This is from the original Raging Heroes Toughest Girl in the Galaxy. Uh-huh. And it's Nertha, the Faceless Mother, if anyone feels like Googling it. And it's a kind of like a witch, kind of with flowing tattered robes, but she's pregnant. And you can't see her face at all. It's kind of covered in this hood. In fact, the miniature literally has no face. And it's perfect for that kind of Viking-esque steer. And it's, yeah, it's absolutely perfect for that. So I'm going to steal Ethan's idea. I'm going to buy one, and then I'm going to roll a double one.
I've never looked at the shiver, but I mean, some of the things, admittedly, if you roll a double one, that's not good. But I mean, some of them are good. I mean, like even an average roll is going to give you, an eight or slightly above average. It's plus D6 XP for the fighter visiting. I mean, that's
reroll. Rerolling natural ones to hit. So yeah. you know, if you've given it like a sight or something, and you're ordinarily hitting on twos, you're basically guaranteed hit all but.
And if you happen to get the 12, you get double XP, double creds, and double rep, and it's like, okay, that's quite good.
Well, that's why I went for the propagandist as well for mine, because with bone pickers being 20 credits and a juve, every time I recruit one on a six, I get another one for free.
Yeah,
but. And again, on that same theme, I then started looking at the other hangers-on that I've never taken, and then looking at the clan chemist. And I kind of dismissed this one, but early campaign, this could be awesome. Last rites, essentially, if one of your matriarchs or queen is killed through either allowing her to die or rolling a 66, she comes back as a death maiden for free. Right. You lose with the equipment, assuming you bottle, otherwise that goes back in your stash anyway. And then you just get a free death maiden out of your death. Plus on top, she's armed with a needle pistol, which, you know, if she were to turn up, it isn't the end of the world. She's got a needle pistol and the fixer skill.
It gives you quite a nice narrative hook to roll with then.
Yeah. And then if nothing else, she also makes all the chems near enough 10 creds because... She reduces the cost of chem alchemy by D6 times 10 credits, which is insane. Bear in mind that, you know, so you might take a 25 credit if you're going to do that, and it's to a minimum of 10, but you might take a 25 credit chem and then go, well, why don't I just stack that one with it and that one with it, roll the dice and see what I get. And more than likely, it'll cost you 10 credits.
Is that the chem dealer? Look, I'm just looking at
This is the Escher
apprentice chemist.
It's Escher only, obviously.
Yeah,
75 cred, so again, expensive, but absolutely awesome. I mean,
what it can do, that's good.
Yeah, and then obviously there's the ammo jack, which, you know, we've all done one of those. The dock, we've all done that. I've played the Dome Runner a few times, and I think for 20 credits, they're not bad. I almost always go with a slopper, so, you know. I've also been toying with the idea of Gang Lookout, but again, it's very mission dependent, and we as a club tend not to worry about the sneak attack rules. I know some people love those rules, some people absolutely hate them. So again, a bit of a hit or miss of a character, but I'm definitely interested in taking one of those two Escher special ones that I've never ever played.
I mean, I toyed with the idea of saving up for the Spiker. I kind of, because I have the model, and I'm like 90 creds. I maybe late game, you know, might find 90 creds to throw at the Spiker, because it's a cool. It does cool things. It's got some much more offensive psychic powers.
Something we haven't really touched on yet is the particulars of this campaign variant, the back to basics variant that James has come up with.
That's true.
How are we finding the universal rewards and that generic territory income?
I really
so
like
far?
It.
I think it's forgiving, that kind of 25 credits, even if you lost. And, you know, just because you lost, the other players on your team might win and therefore you might get even more. So I think it's quite forgiving for the newer players, which is, in my opinion, no bad thing. The campaign definitely feels more credit rich than the past couple we've done. Where we've been earning multiples of D6, not D6 times 10, multiples of D6.
Yeah.
And then it being expected to maintain gangs with vehicles and lost fighters and... So it definitely feels much more credit rich, which feels a bit weird having money to spend or not. In fact, you know, I'm actually saving money, which is feels dirty. But aside from that, no, I think it is a good thing that, again, very much apt for this campaign because we are introducing new players to the campaign. You know, it sucks losing a model and then not being able to replace it.
I think the only thing on that regard for me is I'll prefix this with I really like it. I think it goes into that whole it's been very simple, no tactics cards. The only thing I have to get someone's like Tom's or Callum's or like a brand new player's feedback of does it set incorrect expectations because they play this and go, oh yeah, Necromunda's great and it can do this, and I kind of, and then they play a campaign where we don't have that, and they get like, you know, the Ash Waste campaign where Lawrence was saying you get like, you know, 2 creds for the game and you've lost 2 games, and it gets really brutal and people can get very low, very dejected very quickly because they feel like they're just being swamped by all of these metrics. And I just pondered the is it too much? Has it gone too much the other way? Is it too the stabilizers are on and like, you know, the kid gloves are on a little bit too much? Just wondered.
Well, bear in mind that the intention of these universal rules is not specifically for just for the back to basics campaign.
No.
Because we have these problems consistently with missions. You know, there are so many now, and the rewards in them are so wildly varied from nothing to everything. that the ignoring territories just for a second, but the universal special rules, I mean, you're talking about if you win the game you get 50 credits, if you lose the game you get 25 credits, and if you draw you both get 25 credits. That's it. So we're not talking vast amounts of money. You can buy a new ganger maybe, or a fairly decent mid-range weapon,
or pay for a doctor,
or potentially pay for a doctor. Yeah. So
I think it just feels extreme from what the last couple of campaigns have been, and again, that's in setting. You know, we've strayed out of the hive, we've been to the very hive bottom, and we've been out in the wastes where the setting was very intentionally credit poor. We've kind of, you know, gone back to Gildersford, where, you know, maybe there are a bit more credits available. It just, in context of where we've been recently, it feels like a lot.
Well, Dixon and I were talking about that, funnily enough, just the other night when we were playing. The Ash Waste campaign that we played, we don't think it's designed to work for the number of players which we typically see now at the club. And perhaps if you were playing and generating the road territories with, say, 4 to 8 players in your campaign, you might find that you're connecting more of the routes, you know, and you're, whereas we were finding we were sort of like stuck, weren't we, fighting the same people for the same road sections. Yeah. Whereas if you're, you know, you've got smaller group, less roads, but lots of different ways to get from A to B, you might find that those extra rewards were procking a little bit more often. And we sort of discussed, you know, what ways would you perhaps run things differently in order to accommodate that. And I don't think we've landed on anything yet, but food for thought. And I wonder if that's why that was such a stark contrast compared to other campaign types that you might have played.
Yeah, I mean, this is the territory income within the Back to Basics campaign is also an experiment for a potential replacement for future campaigns, because again, Ash Waste or Dominion or, you know, whatever one that involves linking anything together, whether that be territories or roads, becomes incredibly difficult when you're talking about 12 to 14 players.
Yes.
Mm. Because if nothing else, simply on the basis that the chance of being able to actually play the person you want to play is quite low, because there's so few players, or so many players, basically, that's a starting point. So you never get to challenge for the roads that you want or the territories that you want in the first place. And then actually, you know, trying to link up more than one territory is really difficult as a result. So I'm trying to find something that works from a map-based campaign perspective, for that visual kind of, you know, putting it into context of Gildersford and their location, that doesn't restrict the players from being able to do what they want to do narratively, and gain those territories and gain those rewards.
That was going to be the one, and again, clutching for negativities, because first impressions, it's going really well, and it feels there's a positive atmosphere because people aren't being, you know, steamrolled in a way previous campaigns have. It's the one thing that, because we have that generic territory income, people aren't claiming the territories with the boons that they offer under a normal Dominion campaign. We lose those little narrative hooks of a dispute over a particular territory kind of building and spilling out and people competing over particular potentially named locations. So I guess that's the one, from a narrative perspective, it's the one little drawback of this mechanic, perhaps.
It is. Although I do have a secondary mechanic which I'm working on that ties in with it, which will hopefully bring, not entirely back, but it will bring an element of that back, which is basically that each territory that you have, you can will be able to perform a post-battle action itself, if that makes sense.
That's an interesting idea.
In many ways, there will be a selection of things that particular territory can do from, as you know, these are not categorical, but either generating X amount of credits or giving you a particular bonus in a following game or allowing you to have access to a rogue dock or a slopper or whatever it might be, that type of thing. So it means, you know, you're still getting that choice. At the end of the game, you go, okay, well, I've got four territories. Do I want to generate four territories worth of income? Or I've got two people that need to go to a doctor. Do I want to use two of those territories to actually have access to rogue docks? Yeah. And then I only get to generate two territories worth of credits. Or I need to call in a favor for the following game. So actually now I'm only going to get one territory's worth of credits. Something along those lines, but it's still very much working.
It's also an opportunity to bring bounty hunters into the mix, isn't it? As an option that we hear so often in the community is overlooked unless it's a particular tactics card or a particular territory boon that they receive that they get a free bounty hunter. People tend not to want to pay out, but if it's an option to bring a mysterious stranger in from a territory, that might give, you know, another opportunity to create narrative hooks in that way.
We were talking about this a couple of days ago, and we were saying, or at least my opinion was very much, you know, if when the game is only the battlefield, it can feel very competitive. And often we're talking about, you know, how do we bring a bit more of those other elements into the game, whether it's exploration or, you know, role-playing or whatever. You know, the secondary mechanics in the game, in particular, like, I really liked the
Outlands
campaign where you build up your settlement. You know, those extra mechanics give people a wider choice of where to spend their credits. And as Dixie was saying, you know, if the choice is, and again, of course, you don't have to go with the published territories, and you know, maybe it's a benefit to your campaign to throw those out and redo them. But you know, if you've got more choice, you know, potentially, you know, you could mix some of these ideas in different campaigns together, where, you know, instead of collecting money from a territory, you enhance that territory by developing it, so that it grants, so it unlocks a future boon for next time. So, for example, maybe you've got a wandering dock, but if you don't collect income for him, essentially you don't shake him down, you know, instead you invest in that guy, he might become a road dock that you could spend as a post-battle action in a future game. But of course another player might take that territory from you after you've developed it. So, you know, there's all sorts of things that we could do with that. And again, you know, I love the idea of opening up more choice than just how do I get the nasty weapon.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, my feeling, especially from the last, the Ash Ways campaign, it did surprise me that the amount of creds available for on a game-by-game basis was so low and so predicated on you actually connecting up the scenarios. And like James said, there was this kind of, it's impossible to actually do that when you've got so many people and so much other stuff going on, that I love this as a way, I'm really super intrigued by James's kind of notion of having territories do something, like some kind of boon or some kind of action or something post game that, you know, maybe you could use it to connect whatever. But I think that having that, not reliability, but just that knowing that you are going to get something and you're not going to roll a die and get one cred or two creds, because that happened to me, and you kind of go, well, what was the point of playing that game? Because, you know, you get your ass handed to you and then you get nothing for it and lose two or three guys. You can see where players, I mean, I think Jacob, I don't think he'd mind me saying this, after one of the games in the Ash Waste, and you could just see, you know, head went down because he was just overwhelmed by what was going on. He was getting no money, he was losing guys, and it kind of feels like there's absolutely no way out. So I do like this this mechanism that levels it slightly and allows people that aren't doing so well to at least keep accruing credits to allow them to do something, maybe change the tactics or change the war gear or something, so that they can you know, have an impact in the next game.
I think the other thing is that with the fixed fee, where it's 25 or 50, at least it takes the swinginess of the dice out of it, because there's nothing worse than, you know, as you say, somebody doing poorly and rolling a one and then having 10 credits, even though, you know, potentially they could have walked away with 60.
Yeah, exactly.
That was the intention, was to just make it, you know, as a minimum going into that game, that the absolute minimum you're going to come away with is 25 credits.
Yeah. And I think that's a good idea.
That's mission income in addition to territory stuff. So again, you know, generally speaking, most people are coming away with about 75 credits worth of stuff.
Yeah. And again, one of my pet hates about Games Workshop games in general is there's unnecessary dice rolls in some cases for mechanics that quite frankly break the game if you roll badly.
It's interesting. They say they don't want that, and then they introduce dice rolls when you kind of think, well, it could be made much more simply by this kind of mechanic. So it's sometimes you think, oh, they could do with the dice roll here, and then other times it's like, no, you know, surely you just get a fixed amount for winning, you know. Anyway,
But anyway, no, in that regard, I think actually it's a really good idea. And again, you know, it helps keep the campaign on an even keel. You know, nobody should slip too far down.
Or too far forward.
Or, for that matter, you know, nobody's rolling 4d6 times 10.
Mm-hmm. Naming no names.
I guess the other thing with this campaign is, by having that, as you say, leveling the playing field with income, there being a steady income even if you're consistently losing, but not having access to the super death rays that the trading post normally offers, it is, as James fully intended, I'm sure, it's encouraging us to just take a punt on some war gear and some equipment we might not otherwise, you know, splash the cash on, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think so. Yeah, I like it. I mean, I like the part of me goes, I'd like a little bit more flexibility in what I could buy from the trading post, but I completely understand that we're going for this thing, and you know, you've got to play within the bounds of the rules, and what can you get, you know, what war gear can you take, or what chems can you take, or what armor, you know, those. And it makes you think about, like Lawrence said, not going straight for the big shiny big gun, which I'm very guilty of.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to, just as a segue, because I think we could go around this for a while, I wanted to get more into the some of the new new rules or the changes to the rules for those that have played, and how do you think that those things that have been tweaked or changed are impacting the way that the games are being played, the play style. Like we've sort of alluded to Medicaid already in terms of people grouping up and what benefits and disadvantages that brings. How are people finding that?
So yeah, I'll jump in straight there with that point, Lee, is that I think that the whole emphasising on assisting with recovery, so getting XP for it, and the negation of flesh wounds for serious injuries and flesh wound results if you're assisting a down fighter. I think they're fantastic additions that actually mean that fighters don't just get left to bleed out, and it makes you adapt the way that you play. And I think that the second thing that I really love is the additions to the injury table. Yes. So when I played Angus in game one, I think I rolled for him multiple injuries, and his head went down. He was like, "Oh no, like that fight is just going to be absolutely mullered." We rolled two results, so rolled twice on the table, and we had to re-roll a few times because we got a lot of out colds. And his fighter ended up walking away with impressive scars and bitter enmity. So cool. Should I ever face him again? Which, you know, created its own narrative, you know. So, I think there's some wonderful additions in there that have really improved the game for me.
The change to assisted recovery, it's a funny one because it's almost such an obvious thing to implement because it's a staple of RPGs for years. Yep. You know, how does your party healer get XP? Yeah. Well, they get it when they heal, obviously. And it's now they've done it. You go, well, why didn't they do that from the outset? It's such an obvious thing, but it's such a welcome addition now.
I wonder whether they should have added assisting with rally tests as well. Because at the moment, if you move your champs or whatever or other fighters within range, you can assist with a rally check. And I think if that then is the difference between it being successful or not, I'd like to see one XP there maybe.
That's good. And you wonder if it actually even almost opens up a class of fighter at some point. You know, obviously we've got our specialists, but actually do we essentially end up with one designated fighter being your Medicare expert in
combat
every game?
Doc, basically.
Yeah. Does it almost feel necessary to bring at least one to keep the game going? You know, if your opponent's able to pick his fighters up off the floor and you can't, does that move the meta a little bit?
I think it might. I mean, again, in the game I played against Tom, where my doc had to show up and I could use the Medicaid skill, it did make a big difference. And so I can completely see that, like that we were talking about earlier, whether it's a juve or the skull, that being cooked in and actually having, you know, a big impact on the game. Because if somebody goes down, just, you know, the juve comes up, fixes the person, great, I'm back up, all the rest of it. I mean, for me, just and on that point, that for me, I adore, and I don't think anyone's shocked by me saying this, and you all know what I'm going to say, I utterly adore the changes to seriously injured and flesh wounds. I think it is, hands down for me, the best thing, long overdue, the best thing that could possibly have happened to the game. I think it's made the games quicker, which again is no bad thing, but yeah, I love it. I mean, and even losing two games on the bounce and, you know, suffering, you know, loads of guys walking around with toughness one because they've taken a bunch of seriously injured and then flesh wounds, I still think it is fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, I'm also a fan of the change to the blast template and the charging round a corner. So minus one weapon skill if you charge a target you can't see. And the minus two flat for aiming at a point on the battlefield. I think they're wonderful. And although the weapon skill one hasn't cropped up for me yet, the blast one certainly has like influenced the choices made when using a blast template on battlefields.
The weapon skill thing has, for me, with my champ, you know, is a kind of a bit of a combat specialist. And I sort of took it on the nose, go, well, he's got pretty good weapon skill because he's the champion. I'm just going to take it. But no, I mean, it does make you think, oh, you know, I'll obviously be at minus one to do that. But yeah, it's still good.
Sorry, go over us.
It helps a little bit because I've always had slight misgivings with a native 2+ trait on anyone. I always think that feels almost too straight away. I mean, if they get it through advancements, fair enough. But yeah, the weapon skill 2+ on a Nacht Ghoul and the weapon the ballistic skill 2+ on a Van Saar to me feels a bit much.
Shots fired.
So the Nacht Ghoul only, quote unquote, hitting on a 3+ because it's slunk around the corner,
yeah,
you know, from an infiltrate infiltrating move.
Exactly.
That's fine. That feels feels like it should be. You know?
I think it's fair enough, especially if you arm it up with things to buff its amount of attacks or the strength it's going in at. I mean I'll take that.
And again, it's tactical choices, isn't it? It's the same reason I dislike the suspensor. It removes a tactical choice. This has introduced tactical choice. Do I hug a wall, take the minus ones a hit, but get a bit of cover on the way in? Or do I essentially stand in the open so I can see you probably get shot on the way in and risk it? And again, that then introduces more tactics to that. If I'm going to go straight in and see you, do I throw a juve in front of you? Do I find some other way of keeping myself on my feet? Again, I know anything that introduces more tactical nuance into the game, I think, is only good.
No, I'd agree with that. I think specifically with the Nat Girl, I think there are... for me, rush of blood to the head, because of course you do the infiltrate, they've got to go with it, they can go out of line of sight, and so immediately you are at that, I'm going to try and charge, and I'm obviously that minus one. You could always be a little bit more tactful and not go straight for the jugular with that kind of move and back it off, and there's always an option. But I don't disagree with anything you said there, Lawrence. More tactics, more option, more choice is good.
And again, the Medicaid has done the same thing. It's introduced a new interesting tactic to the game. It's essentially added another dimension that we previously were never playing. Nobody even really cared about the Medicaid skill unless you were Fansar, I think, had easy access to it, maybe Orlok.
Yeah. Or if you had the road dock at the end of the battle.
Yeah.
I'd like to know if anybody's actually used the new Hurl and Headbutt skills yet, because I know James took Hurl but didn't actually get an opportunity to use it in our game. But has anyone come across that where someone else used it on them?
No, not yet.
No.
I suppose we don't have a lot of Goliath players in the campaign, and I don't think there's been a lot of Cordor games yet. But I'm quite interested to see how they work out, considering they've had some big changes to them.
I think what will be interesting is the fearsome mechanic coming in play just about almost all the time through the second half of the campaign, because I've given it
through
at least,
injuries, you mean?
I've given that to at least two players.
Well, I got it through Impressive Scars the other day.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've done that to Ethan's
Horrific.
Leader.
Horrific
Scars, yeah. Horrific. And, and one of Tom's characters. So, yeah, I can see that becoming a much more significant part of the game.
One of the things that I'm really like, again, from my perspective, I don't know if you've found this yet, Roscoe, with your psychic powers, but I like the fact that the continuous effect is now a simple action. So you pull it off and then you can keep it going. So some of, I've gone for spatial psychosis where I'm getting a 10-inch bubble of full cover. And I love the fact I can just go, I'm just going to keep that going and move. And so you kind of, I rather than having to do the willpower check, I think that's, I know a lot
you
of people
still have to do. You still have to do the willpower check.
So I haven't invested in psychic, but as I understand it, the way that now works, it can be a free action.
It's a free action.
Prior to
it's a free action.
Yeah. But you don't get the positive modifier that you otherwise would if it were treated as a basic. So they've given versatility. You have that option. If you have a good native willpower, then you might feel confident to keep that continuous psychic power rolling and still use your two actions. You may decide, actually, I'm not feeling confident without that 3+. I'm going to sacrifice, so to speak, an action to persist if that's still advantageous to you. So it's given some versatility for sure. I haven't gone spooky with my Dalak, but I am thinking about that as maybe my downtime purchase, perhaps.
I'm trying to find it. I haven't got the book. I left the book out in the car from last night. I'm just using Necrodamus to try and find it. Continuous effect.
Yeah, essentially, it's you get it as a free action, and as Ross said, that if you take the free version, you do a standard willpower check in order to continue the action. Which obviously if you fail, then the action finishes, but you still get your two actions anyway, your two normal actions.
Yeah.
Or you can use one of your normal actions to get the +3 basic modifier to the willpower check to continue the power.
I read that wrong.
It doesn't automatically continue the power just by taking the free action.
I can't even find it.
No, the in terms of in terms of the sort of usability for Dalak in particular, and I may have touched on this in the previous episode, but I noticed that the murder squid, obviously that isn't the trademarked name, the Piscean Spectre.
Yeah,
I'm happy to stand corrected there, but it comes, despite a few reviews saying contrary, it comes as standard with the unsanctioned psyker rule. So it can, without an additional purchase, have a psychic ability from the Dalak lists at launch. And that could include the one where it gains cover, even if it's out in the open.
Psychoteric Whisper.
And that,
Perfect Void.
That's the one. And that specifically for the Murder Squid, I thought was a very strong, potentially strong use where... You touched on obviously the modifier to charging now if they're out of line of sight, but if you can cast that in a previous turn, rely on its native willpower to carry it through to the next turn, you can have it stood right out in the open, ready to get a charge off with full line of sight, knowing that any shots against it are going to be struggling potentially or finding it harder to hit it prior to getting that charge off.
Which is the thing I was doing with my. Sorry.
Page 153, Lee. Sorry.
I haven't got the book. It's in the car. I'm literally on Necrodamus. So the search is not helping me here, which is unusual because the search is very good on Necrodamus. But but to your point, Ross, that's exactly what I was trying to do, obviously incorrectly, but with my Nat Girl.
Oh, I see. Gotcha.
So I gave the Nat Girl a perfect void. So in that thing, I can walk it out into the open and still effectively in cover. That was the idea. And then if I wasn't going to get the charge off, I could move and still be close, you know, get closer and be in cover with the idea of being able to charge the following turn was the idea.
So one thing I'd like to point out is that last night I got to play a brand new player, their first game. And, you know, naturally it was a little bit slower and, you know, pointing things out and giving them some steers, etc. But Callum's been able to digest the new book and, you know, we referred to a few things within it. And, you know, there's now an index which made things easy to find. Like when we looked up exotic beasts and I explained to him how they work in terms of group activation and this, that and the other. And the actual core rules just being laid out succinctly and, you know, just very well written now that they've, you know, certain things have been FAQ'd, etc. I think that there's never been a better time to try and convince somebody that plays another system to come and give Necromunda a go. And actually it's accessible considering how crunchy a rule set it can be. You know, one of the other new guys was there and he literally commented like, I've come from 40K. And the thing that's really drawn me to this is the, you know, the I go, you go activations. And
well, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, it was a really interesting thing Callum said in the previous episode that I was absent for, that he saw the rules as quite streamlined when a very common community complaint is rules bloat, book bloat, that it's too dense, that there's so many grey areas because of the sheer amount of supplementary rules that have been launched. So it is interesting that this book, if it were presented to a player of another system, that they're actually finding it's intuitive and it's relatively straightforward, which is great. We want,
yeah, absolutely.
If you want to go down the rabbit hole of supplementary rules and meta, then you know, by all means. But you don't want people put off, do you? You want to be able to ease them in with a really nice.
Which is where this campaign comes in beautifully, and I think actually, you know, it's one of those things where, I mean, I know Dixie talked about this before, we're running two campaigns in tandem where if you've got enough players for the kind of the new players to play this and then more experienced players maybe go off and do something completely different. But yeah, I mean, I think absolutely, and the you go, I go activation thing is something, I mean, as an aside, I think 40K has needed that for years and still hasn't got it.
Well, interestingly, he came over and he said, like, you know, I've just seen somebody finish a game, turn two, just completely tabled the other player.
Yeah.
You know, and those people have turned up. They've spent hours painting armies, putting them together, put it all on a table, and then half an hour later, they've packed up and they've gone home again.
Exactly.
And we got a whole evening's worth of gaming out of, you know, like, what, eight and seven models.
Exactly. I mean, I've played 40K games where I've got to the end of turn one, and I haven't actually, but you go, well, I've lost that, you know, you, because you lose so much stuff from like a whole gun line of shooting, and you're like, well, I can't possibly compete now. And so if you played a you go, I go type thing in with those sort of scenarios, it would dramatically, like fundamentally change the game, and just, it needs it, but they'll never do it.
Well, it's interesting. We're talking to a couple of other players, and Ethan was kind enough to give me a demo game of Star Wars Legion. And that's got an interesting mechanic whereby it's still I go, you go, but aside from a little bit of your hand of card tactics that you can manipulate the game with, the units that you're going to draw in order aren't yours to decide. They come out randomly to an extent. So, for example, you know, you've got, what, maybe five or six classifications of units, and you pull the card off the top of the deck, and it tells you what unit you're activating, and then you have to activate one of those. So if you've got lots of troop choices, then you can choose to activate the right one that's relevant for that situation. But if you got unlucky and you end up pulling a support when you actually needed a fast unit, you've got to deal with the tactical situation in front of you. And it's quite an interesting mechanic. Again, you know, you're still going, but you can't necessarily just jump the gun. And again, what I was talking to Tom about last night was, again, being a new player, you know, the first thing he chose to do is, after I had targeted a fighter and by chance missed, he decided that he was going to react and move that fighter. I said, well, hang on, before you do that, consider, is that fighter in danger anymore? Also, is that the most danger that any of your fighters are in, or is there a better choice to make? But again, you know, if some of that choice were taken away, and, you know, again, if we imagine we had the same system, and you say, cool, okay, well, I am required to activate a Juve. I can activate any Juve, but I'm required to activate a Juve. It's just the situation you're in. You know, sometimes that can make for some interesting choices, you know, and especially where you've got the priority, you know, I'm going first and I'm obviously going to charge that person before they get charged. If that's not within your choice, again, even Necromunda's got some opportunities there to make the game more complicated, but potentially more tactically challenging.
It's interesting. We could try it. I mean, because you can make the cards and then just randomly shuffle them and then pull them. And so there's your activation for that could be an interesting test game once this campaign's done.
Yeah, I say it comes from Star Wars Legion, and I think that's a really, really interesting game mechanic.
Haven't played it, probably should. So we have a little bit of time left. So I think we've been working on some interesting hobby stuff for the campaign, both the terrain and for our gang. So briefly, what have people been doing, focusing on, and obviously with everything that we've discussed this evening, what are you going to be focusing on for the next couple of games?
Go on, I'll go first this time. So, you know, in prep for this campaign, again, I was painting a couple of models that I'd never put paint on. So like the Fear Cat. I'd chosen to dig out some of my original N17 models that, you know, were just equipped with the basic stuff that probably never sees the light of day again. So it was a case of touching up some of those paint schemes. Wasn't repainting, but kind of just improving. And again, because this campaign's kind of encouraged the leaders to be a bit more tooled than I normally go, I did a kit bash conversion of an Escher leader with the chem thrower and a stiletto knife, which was quite a nice conversion to do. And I used a pose that I don't usually use as well, one of the one that's kind of looks like she's kind of about to fall over sideways. But
yeah.
Then aside from that, kind of going forward, I'm now looking for what I want to use as my junior clan chemist. I have to admit, I can't stand the 412 model for it. So I'm looking through my bits box, deciding what I'm going to use for that. If I ever accrue the credits to recruiter.
Or go on my manufacturer and find something interesting to print.
Perhaps, yep. Yep. But yeah, no, that's kind of been me. As I say, with a lot of real life interfering this recently, but yeah.
Gaz, obviously with your Sardaukar, you've got some red edging to do.
Yeah, it just turns out I've got some extra detail work to do on them. I again, I've really enjoyed the modelling aspect this time around. I took the Vansar Champ with the Las Cannon from Forge World that's leaning against the bent girder, because I really liked like the extra chunky like boots and armor, and I thought that would make a great base for a leader model. And then I magnetized the arms on it so that I could you try out the Rad Cannon for this campaign, and you know whether or not it makes it into the next one, we'll find out. I really enjoyed doing that, and I tried some OSL for the first time. Using a dry brush because I don't own an airbrush, and I'm kind of I feel like I could do a bit better. I did a bit of a rush job just to get them tabletop ready. They still need some extra detail work, but it's finding time at the moment with the kids.
Dry brushes, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, the guys from Artis Opus, as much as I'm not a fan of their brushes, he's an absolute genius with the dry brush. So I mean,
well, do you know what, shout out to him, because that's the video I watched. The he's recently done an OSL video, and I think it was Element Games sent out an email with like, you know, this week in the hobby or something, and I saw that lot, and that, again, shout out Element Games. I think it's fantastic that they bothered to do that. It's just a group of like really nice put together tutorials or things that are going on, so worth signing up just for that email, I think. That's how I came across it, and that's what I've tried out, albeit not with the brushes and the sponge and everything like he's got. I probably need to upgrade my tool set, but thoroughly enjoyed that, and a little bit of green stuff and work on there. And I did the same for the Archaeotech, and now I want to do a grav cutter mixed with one of the hands from the Warcry Tarantulus Brood, where there's like a web, and I kind of want the guy surfing on the board and using the web to kind of pull the front of it up, or you know, pull the back up, something like that. So that's going to be my next conversion for this campaign. So I've just got to pull my finger out and find some time.
Ross,
sort of leading from what Gareth was saying, you got to go for the small victories, and I was really happy to get my Dalak tabletop ready. They're not layered, they still need some washes, but it was nice to start a campaign with a gang that were, you know, they were good enough, and it was nice, you know, I feel like I'm kind of holding my end up at the table if I can do that. Each their own, of course. But yeah, the Tenebrous Coil, as I'm calling my Dalak, the nothing too crazy. I have got all of the Forge World resin and then the plastic accessories, so when it comes to putting them together, sometimes I'm a bit prone to coming up with weird internal canon rules. So my gangers and any dupes I might have, they have the most basic of heads. They have sort of minimal augmentation, and just leaning into that Dalak, this idea that they're all doppelgangers of each other. You know, there's very little variation. And then then as you move up the gang, they've got slightly more interesting ones. So my grav gun wielding leader's the only one with a sort of obligatory emo kid hood over his head, and then my two long las gunners have both got sort of goggles and masks on. But going forward, I've just finished this snake companion for my Nactgull, and I'm dithering, because with this campaign variant we do know what the scenarios are coming up. So it's not a case of metagaming, but I am slightly worried for the kicking that my Dalak might take in the big bar brawl if it does indeed go ahead next week. So I'm wondering about not so much how I can win the game as how my spooky boys cannot take the kicking that they might. Because I'm not convinced Dalak drink, if I'm honest. I know they own a lot of the bars and the gambling dens, but I don't know if it's on. I don't know if it's in theme for them to get tanked up on Wild Snake, or whether they should stay sober and run the risk of getting a kicking from the drunk Goliath in the room. I don't know.
Use their psychic powers, because that's the thing I'm interested in next week, you know.
Yeah, powers. I may have made a misstep there.
But maybe we can have a showdown, the old the techie smart guys versus, you know, the frail ones in their own little private drinking bar, getting tipsy off of one beer.
Yeah,
fair enough.
Because at the moment, most of my fighters are weapon skill. You know, my champs are weapon skill 4, and the rest of the gang's weapon skill 5.
Yeah.
Terrible initiative across the board. I think my best initiative roll was a 4.
So, I did jump ahead and have a look at the scenario, and it's an interesting one with the intoxication rules for that scenario. Is if you drink, your toughness goes up 1, but your weapon skill goes down 1. So there's a sweet, I'm terrified for toughness 5 Goliaths who can just about still throw a punch.
Well, is anybody even playing Goliaths in the camp?
No, but it's a hypothetical Goliath I'm scared of. This is the shadow that Colin casts across my psyche.
Toughness 5, Death Maiden, still hitting on threes.
Nice. I was going to say, it's going to be a good week for Escher.
My redemptionist with their braziers will be accidentally pretty good because their unarmed attacks gain blaze from those as well.
Nice.
That's war gear.
You can't use war gear. Yeah. No war gears are allowed.
You can't use war gear.
Leave it at the door, mate.
Perfect. Well, that's fine then. I'll just be back to my unarmed bone pickers punching everyone.
So from weight of numbers,
thing that does something.
Spreading the word of Malachi one fist at a time.
Yeah. It's something we haven't actually discussed off air yet. But I was wondering, James, whether we don't roll out my old homebrew bottle throwing mechanic that I came up with previous barb rules, which gave those range gangs a bit more of survivability because they could go up to a table and fling bottles at each other.
Possibly. You have to send those over to me again, so I can remind myself how it works. Yeah, yeah.
So for me, the Dalak, I mean, again, we're doing the permadeath, or I'm doing the permadeath, and no one's died. Or actually, last game I got a 61, but the doc sorted that out. So actually, so far, no actual permanent model death. But I've spent most of my time, actually, I did a pretty quick sort of dry brushy paint job on the printed models, and I've been spending most of my time on my Zone Mortalis board, which I'm pretty happy with. Got it up to full. I've actually got enough tiles to do 4x4, but we're playing 3x3, everything 3D printed, and done some nice water effects, green sump. And what I'm working on at the minute is I want to do some themed individual tiles. So like I've got the market, so I thought I'd do a kind of a permanent setup for the market board, and then do something maybe like a sump sewer kind of thing, maybe with a monster coming, or maybe fit like the back fin of a big like sump monster coming out of it, something like that.
Nice. So
that is kind of it's on the slate. I've got to decide on the model and exactly what I want to do with 3D print, and also the biggest issue is storage, because right now all the tiles are completely flat, and then obviously just the Zone Mortalis walls just sit on top, so it sits very nicely in one of the boxes that aforementioned by Orozco. But it's more the whole, if I start doing kind of larger static boards, that especially like the market board, that's going to be potentially difficult to store. So I'm kind of contemplating the particulars of that. The gang, I mean, I need to 3D print another ganger to fit the infill the ghost that I hired this week. And that's basically it. I'm just waiting for the gavel or the bell to come down and smash one of my gang members to do something different. But you know, it hasn't happened yet. Looking forward to it, actually. I really am. I sort of really secretly like the idea of playing permadeath necromancer.
We'll make sure we get it on video when it does happen.
Yep.
I heard the sort of the shock in Colin's voice when you sort of said to him, oh, and by the way, if you actually kill one of my fighters, you actually get to destroy the model. And I heard him go, I'm sorry.
He didn't believe me. He was like, what? You'll get to like smash it? And I was like, yep, absolutely. And he, okay.
It's just a horrible idea, isn't it, for anyone who's ever poured hours and hours into creating something.
I think it's to some degree, it's the full sense of security is probably the wrong way to describe it. The flippancy that you get because I know that the models are just, I can just print them out at it with impunity. Now that I obviously, you know, bought the files and I can print them. Okay. The time to paint them, but I'm spending maybe less than 10 minutes on the actual printing painting. It's just, you know, very quick dry brush and washes. I'm not doing anything even remotely difficult, and so I kind of look at it as just that's fine. If they were legit real models, different story, but this is why I like the notion of doing it with a 3D printer, because then it's just like, oh, it died and off it goes.
Well, in truth, it depends on your mood. It depends how badly you've just lost.
Well, that's true as well. That is, I've decided on that regard, for people that don't remember me destroying that Blackstone Fortress Psyker, I'm going to buy a frame, and I think I'm going to frame it in on the sprue still, so I can actually, yeah, just a permanent reminder of no model is too whatever it is to get destroyed.
I mean, that's not a bad memory, is it?
No. I just wish I'd got the recording of Ross squeaking when I did it.
I'm just thinking, what was that?
Your little tantrum was worth it, mate.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I don't mind doing that, but it was, yeah, just brilliant.
What was that incredibly rare Imperial Guard sergeant, the one that was a homage to Predator, and it only made it into a handful of independent stockists? If you broke one of those, if you immolate one of those, I don't know what I'd do.
Do you mean the female one that was like a Ripley chap. Or...
Is it Carl Weathers?
The one with the power fist. The one with the power fist.
Yeah.
With the fist on the ground.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a sliding scale of what you do it to. So, I mean, you know, if you go and buy a ridiculously overpriced model from Forge World, no, you don't treat those badly. But, I mean, I think those Blackstone Fortress models I bought off eBay for a couple of quid each, and so I just don't really care, if I'm completely honest with you. So there is a sliding scale of what I'm prepared to throw around the room. But at the end of the day, to me, they are just plastic toy soldiers. I don't really care all that much, if I'm completely honest.
You're an animal.
I know. I am. But, you know, I've been doing it long enough and whatever. You know, but your mileage may vary, you know, and you can't maybe be so flippant about it. I am not recommending this to everybody. But if you have a 3D printer or you have access to a 3D printer and you feel like being a little bit dangerous, maybe try some permadeath and Necromunda.
Definitely send the videos in to us at Guildsford Radio, please.
Considering the chemicals involved, I think that's poor for the environment, Lee.
You've seen the environment on Necromunda, right?
Exactly.
That's not our goal. That's not what we're aspiring to, I don't think. A warning, surely.
Well, true. That's yes. Yeah, fair enough.
Anyway, moving on.
I suppose then my counter would be, all right, that's fair. I'll get biodegradable resin and then it's biodegradable and we'll call it quits.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
As the resident conservationist, Lee, as long as you implement, you build it into a future terrain piece, it's fine. I'll give you a free pass.
That's a shout. That's not a bad idea. Like, you know, nice water effect, and yeah, okay.
You could have like an accumulative, like a corp processing plant, and the body parts from each murdered model go into ponds.
Oh, yeah, that's okay. That is a shout. Okay, fair enough. Yes,
or maybe monster on a large chair with all their skulls.
You just need a hole in a Zone Mortalis tile and some poor sap with a shovel just pushing bits of broken Dalak into the hole.
One of my permanent pieces. That's yes, some fantastic ideas for future projects there, boys. Love that. That's awesome. Okay, Dixie, did we ask you what you're doing? You're working on Malachi, aren't you?
No, not yet. Yeah, so I've been slightly sidetracked because I've been actually making a one-to-one scale replica of an 1870s Gatling gun Broadwell drum magazine, as you do, you know.
Gatling gun, people. Gatling gun.
Yeah, Gatling guns. So that's kept me quite busy. But that's finished now. I can turn my attention. It did work. It worked very, very well up until we got it into the arena and it ran out of gas.
Oh.
But at least it works and it looks fantastic. So I'm quite pleased with it. But so I can turn my attentions back to Malachi now. I have some credits. I need to recruit some more bone pickers. So I need to whack out the old, I'm using the new zombie models and using the ones that
ones from Curse City.
Curse City, that's the one. Picking the ones that look slightly more human, but they look very good as kind of bedraggled hive citizens with no weapons. I just need to set some time aside to slap some paint on those and get some more people done, basically.
Cool. Well, that's awesome. What more do we have to say? Anything we've missed? I think we've had a really interesting chat tonight, fellas. Anything to add before we close out?
Just closing as we started, I think.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear from the community if they've got a Dear Dixie query, if they've got a Stack of Wax submission. Yeah. If they've got any hobby progress of any kind, we'd love to hear. And of course, if you are using any of our community supplements yourselves, whether you're out on our Ash Waste map or whether you have in fact gone back to basics yourselves.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see whether other groups have used the Back to Basics campaign and how they're finding it.
Yes, I think we would. All, as with everything that we're doing, you know, we love the fact that we're getting the feedback. You know, the guys over in that are using Lawrence's stuff. We love that. Anyone else using it, yeah, it's great. Right, well, if that's the case and we're done, I'd like to thank everyone for who's listened this far. It's been fantastic. If you like what you heard, that's great. You know, tell your friends about it. And if you don't, well, you've listened this far and it's quite impressive. So that's bye from me and have a fantastic gaming month.
Have a good evening.
Cheers.
Cheerio.
Catch you later.
Take it easy, guys. Bye.
You've been listening to Gilders for Radio. Broadcasting live all across the Sump, the High, Outlands, and the far reaches of the Ash Wastes.